This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Can those guys play or what? Yeah.
Thank you.
I think I heard some strains of Rights of Man in there, didn't I? Let's see what the Chieftains do with that song. Thank you. Get enough of those Yulian pipes, eh? Let's hear some more of the Yulian pipes.
I was born in Turkey, 30 times. Thank you. in Turkey 30,000 years ago. I taught the women and the men the things that they should know. The patriarchs invaded and I was forced to roam. I am an ancient matriarch a long way from my home. So I escaped to Brittany, way up in northern France. I met some girls with hairy balls who thought they wore the pants. Until I had them brought to me inside my pleasure dome. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home. Across the channel I was called to help the Celts carouse, where fungi flourished on the plops and droppings of the cows. In jest I said, in jest these things, and thus the henge was stoned. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home. Then across the Irish Sea I boldly made my way, where I was worshipped as a queen on each St. Bridget's Day. Invading Brits disdained my tips and threw me from my throne. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home. Amongst the Appalachians I then did take my stand. Likewise in Nova Scotia and up in Newfoundland. In New Orleans, them voodoo queens embraced me as their own. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home. It's now in California belongs, where paunchy bars and Star Trek guards sing airs of Gaelic songs. Till Madame Pele calls me, I shall no longer roam. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home. I am an ancient matriarch, a long way from my home.
And thus the henge was stoned. Gotta love it. 12:30 in the morning. Here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. Here in New York City, this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we just got out of a half-hour St. Patrick's Day set, quite obviously. We, a whole bunch of slides, jigs, reels, and hornpipes. And if you can tell the difference between a slide, a jig, a reel, and a hornpipe just by listening, well, you're doing better than me. But I do know what I like, and man, do I like that stuff. All right, so the last cut that we just heard, which was the most tongue-in-cheek and the least authentic, of course, was The Rhyme of the Ancient Matriarch by Holly Tannen and her Hosts of the Half-Astral Plane. Get it? The half-astral plane? What a joker that Holly Tannen is. But I had to include that one because, you know, I mean, the thing that always strikes me as so funny about St. Patrick's Day is that it's a Christian holiday. It's a Catholic holiday in its origin. You know, the famous legend about St. Patrick is that he drove the snakes out of Ireland, which is, of course, a metaphor or an analogy or whatever for driving the pagans out of Ireland, as popular interpretation goes. And yet the holiday as we celebrate it today is such a bacchanalia and obviously is more pagan than Christian in its honoring. So just thought we'd play that. Before that was the more deep rootsy and authentic stuff, the jigs, reels, and the hornpipes on, well, we opened with The Flowing Bowl, And a whole bunch of others. It's a medley, including the Masons Men and a whole bunch of other jigs, reels, and hornpipes by Solas from their wonderful first album. Unfortunately, I don't have any of their subsequent albums. I should really get them. But so it seems like almost every St. Patrick's Day I drag out this one. But really, really good stuff. Really, really good stuff. Those guys can definitely play. And before that, you know, I wasn't able to find any new Irish music, so we're just playing old Irish music tonight. Before that, we were trading off on the Julian pipes with Robbie Hannon, and on the flute with Paul McGrattan. Don't even have the names of those albums, actually. This is something which, with the help of Grayson Challenger, I salvaged from my deep, deep, deep archives from cassette recordings I actually made. Not even sure if this music originated from the personal collection of Peter Lamborn Wilson or from our friends at the Rudy Blesch Ragtime Society, but undoubtedly one or the other. But this stuff must have been recorded, oh, I don't know, a long time ago, no later than the 80s. I can pretty much guarantee you that. Might have been even in the 70s or the 60s. Robbie Hannon on the Julian pipes and Paul McGrattan on the flute, hopping back and forth between the two, and we'll dip into some more of that. And just because I noticed that that Robbie Hannon on the Julian pipes was playing one of the songs here, although it's not actually labeled Rights of Man. It sounded just like Rights of Man, or he incorporated a little bit of Rights of Man into what he was blowing there. So I just wanted to play the Chieftains version of Rights of Man, and so we heard that too. So there you go. So for all of you who are feeling a bit sluggish and drinking too much green beer today, I hope that picked you up a little bit. So I've got more music that I want to get to. This is going to be a pretty music-heavy show, I think, because I kind of, you know, did a lot of kvetching last week, so maybe I should leave the kvetching behind for a week, get back to the kvetching tip next week. I know all of you gluttons for punishment out there just can't wait for me to get back to the kvetching, but I only have a little bit of kvetching to do today. Actually, I don't really have any kvetching to do today. All right, just a little. Should I do the kvetching now to get it out of the way, or should we hear some more Julian pipes first? I say we hear some more Julian pipes. You know, the thing is, I'm losing track of what I've already played. I think I was up to cut 6 on the Julian pipes, wasn't I? Let's see what's going on. Well, this isn't Julian pipes, is it? It's flute. But that's okay, it still sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I know that's a horrible, horrible, horrible tease, but, you know, I just played the wrong Solas cut. That's the one I was saving to go out with. And actually, I wanted to transition into the more somber part of the show. So please forgive the false start here, but actually, I guess it's this one that I want to play, the next one. Exquisite, despite my false start there. Sorry about that. And the earlier false start actually was I played a little bit of Holly Tannen on top of the Ulian pipes by mistake, but it actually sounded pretty good, even though it was a mistake. Anyway, that was couldn't play Solas without hearing some of the golden voice of Karen Casey. singing a song called Siab Gil Kua Nafele, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, which I'm probably not, which was written in, according to the liner notes, in 1890 by Pedrag O'Malley, who was an exile working in the coal mines of Wales. This haunting song is a lament, a cry of loneliness and anguish at being exiled from the thing he loved most in the world, Ireland. Many thanks to Annie Wechalag and Michael and Asin O'Sutru for their help with the transcription and translations of the Irish, and to Seamus Brady for introducing me to it in the first place, translation by Asin O'Sutru, again, if I'm pronouncing the names correctly. Well, there you go, a little bit of background on the song we were just listening to, a little bit of cultural and political context. And, all right, now that was the first of three slightly more somber songs, which I plan to play tonight. And here, moving to a very different part of the world, from Ireland to Central America, let's hear our next somber song by a Nicaraguan group back in the 1980s called Guarda Barranco, which is named for the national bird of Nicaragua. But the song is actually about El Salvador and is thusly named El Salvador from Guarda Barranco, from their album Si Buscabas, way back in 1985 when things were really, really bad in El Salvador.
Un beso de polvo sobre el agua enciende volcanes con su amor, alzando el invierno que esperamos. Nace del centro de estos días, vida buscando la armonía. Nace del centro de este abismo, fuego para andar. Hoy crece en su mirada en ese beso, en El Salvador, en El Salvador. Un beso de polvo sobre el agua, en El Salvador. Thank you.
A real shame that there are some minor glitches on that CD, apparently, or the player here in the studio had some trouble reading it. I'll have to see what I can do about that. Real shame, because what a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song. Oh, well, it was only slightly marred by the usual technological obstacles. Well, I should say that it's 2 minutes after 1 o'clock in the morning here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And my name is Bill Weinberg, and this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we just heard a song entitled El Salvador by a group called Guarda Barranco from Nicaragua way back in the mid-1980s when things were really hot and heavy in Central America. And that song contains the line, Nace del centro de este abismo, vida para salvar al istmo, born in the middle of this abyss, life to be the salvation of the isthmus. And the isthmus, of course, being the isthmus of Central America. And I have to say that I'm really, really heartened by the news from El Salvador, a real sign of real, absolutely witnessed history. El Salvador is such a small country, but and would seem to be so insignificant in the great global scheme of things. But for those who recall 20 years ago, when it was one of the last front lines on the Cold War, this really is a very significant thing which we've just witnessed. And along with the strikes which are sweeping Europe from one end to another, and the youth uprising in Greece, and the university walkouts in France, one's starting to get the sense that maybe the tide is really shifting in some fundamental sense on this planet. And, you know, I should say that I was never a wholehearted supporter of the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, the FMLN, in the same sense that I am, you know, a wholehearted supporter of the Zapatista National Liberation Front in Mexico. Because, you know, back in the day, as much as I drew a great deal of inspiration, back in the day, meaning the 80s, of course, as much as I drew a great deal of inspiration from the real, genuine heroism which was displayed by many in El Salvador in the most trying of circumstances. I mean, just a world-class war crimes were going on in El Salvador at that time, thoroughly backed by the Reagan administration, which was in power. El Salvador was then the third largest recipient of U.S. aid in the world after Israel and Egypt. Tiny little El Salvador in Central America, the third largest recipient of U.S. aid, overwhelmingly military aid, on the planet, playing pretty much the same role that Colombia is today. And the same sorts of horrific abuses, disappearances, massacres were going on then that are going on in Colombia today. Possibly even worse in El Salvador 20 years ago than in Colombia today. Again, you know, as much as I really drew inspiration from the people who showed real, genuine heroism, particularly proud atheist that I am, the people in the Catholic Church in El Salvador who really put their lines on the line for the truth and for the people and for justice. The FMLN was, as much as I wanted to root for them, you know, they were kind of caught up in the whole Cold War dynamic of the day, and they were sort of subject to all the dogmatism and doctrinaire authoritarianism that went along with that. And, well, certainly, in terms of human rights violations, they didn't even hold a candle up to the army and the death squads, which were, as I say, really committing world-class atrocities, world-class war crimes at this time. Still, the FMLN's hands were not entirely clean on that point either, and they did carry out some extrajudicial executions of dissidents within their own ranks and that sort of thing. You know, since then, especially if you go to their website today, they and take a look at them wearing suits and ties, and they've eliminated the five-pointed star and the other, you know, two Marxist-looking imagery from their logo. Now they seem to become a little bit, looking a little bit too corporate, a little bit too technocratic, and certainly a lot of their rhetoric has been quick to emphasize that, you know, they don't want any problem with Uncle Sam, they want to play ball, and they're post-socialist, and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, they're also saying that they want new programs to benefit the poor in El Salvador, and you know, they sort of had to... do the whole song and dance of distancing themselves from Hugo Chavez, because that was the brush which was being used to tar them, of course. And while ARENA, the right-wing party, which has been in power for 20 years in El Salvador, and we should note that before ARENA, there were various military-backed, really vicious right-wing regimes, going all the way back to the 1940s, when there was a brief democratic spring in El Salvador. We'll say more about the history in a few moments, but that was, you know, I mean, that was ARENA's tactic, was to say that that they were just, you know, these dangerous foreign agents or puppets of Hugo Chavez, the FMLN. And one particularly sinister tactic which ARENA used was to warn that if the FMLN got into power, that they would be on, you know, El Salvador would be on the outs of Uncle Sam, and the Salvadorans living in the United States would get kicked out or would no longer be able to send money home. And there were some Republicans on Capitol Hill who echoed these threats in extremely sinister and unprincipled manner, particularly Representative Dan Burton of Indiana. So this fortunately did not prevail. And, of course, you know, both the FMLN in El Salvador went out of their way to say, no, we don't want any trouble with Washington. And here in the United States, our friends at CISPES, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, launched a letter-writing campaign to get the Obama State Department to declare its neutrality in the race, which it did. And this was carried by all of the newspapers in El Salvador. You know, the State Department put out some declarations saying that we're going to respect the elections, and we're going to respect the result of the elections. There aren't going to be any retributions taken against Salvadorans living in the United States or any of that. And this was carried by all the newspapers in El Salvador, and the right wing's campaign of threats and fear and dirty tricks did not work. And it was a real victory. And upon coming to power, upon winning the election, Mauricio Funes, who is the FMLN's now president-elect, their candidate and now president-elect, said that this is going to be a... he took the high road. Instead of, you know, demonizing ARENA, he said we're going to respect them in opposition, and that this election is going to be a new accord on peace and reconciliation, which basically refers to the... to the 1992 UN brokered peace agreement, which put an end to the civil war in El Salvador, meant that the FMLN was going to transition from being a guerrilla movement to being a an electoral political party with, you know, guarantees for their right to organize and their right to the political process without you know, fear of reprisal or recrimination. So, finally, you know, it's like sort of in the long shadow of Death Squad terror, which prevailed in El Salvador throughout, really from the late 1970s right on through the early 90s, in fact, for more than just the decade of the 80s. But it was at its worst in the 80s. It took more than my goodness, how many years it took from 1992 to 2009. That's 9 plus 8 is 17. It took, is my math right? 17 years it took for finally, with the sort of global turning of the tide here, and the ideology of the free market right being discredited on the global scale, and finally El Salvador coming out from under the shadow of the, you know, the implicit threat of that the death squads could come back, and there were in fact, you know, flickers of death squad activity continuing throughout on into the 90s and even into whatever decade it is that we're in now, into the aughts. Finally, the FMLN has achieved power, and not through arms, but through the democratic process. And I must say, of all of the, you know, as grim as the world situation is, and it certainly is very, very grim in many, many ways, you know, throughout the last, 8 years of Bush, I just felt like it's just worse and getting worse every day. And it's just this downward spiral into permanent war and totalitarianism on a global scale. And now I feel like things are in flux, and there's still, you know, grave dangers all around us, but there's also significant glimmers of hope on the horizon. And what we've just witnessed in El Salvador is a significant glimmer of hope. And to say a little bit on historical context here, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, the FMLN, takes their name from the communist leader of the 1930s in El Salvador, Farabundo Martí, who was a contemporary of César Sandino in Nicaragua, who led the guerrilla insurgency against the U.S. Marines who were occupying the country at that time. And they knew each other, and they were friends, but they were also, they didn't quite see eye to eye. Sandino was a much more interesting historical figure, it has to be said. He was an anarchist and a mystic, actually, and an apocalyptic visionary, altogether a more interesting historical figure than Farabundo Martí, who was a real sort of party line, common turn kind of guy, just kind of following the Moscow line. Farabundo Martí was leading an uprising of the peasants in 1932 in El Salvador, which was put down by extreme violence in an episode which is now known as the Matanza, or the massacre, quite obviously, in which it's uncertain how many people lost their lives. The figure which historians have traditionally accepted has been 10,000. But in fact, it's been upwardly revised as historical research has brought to light new evidence in recent years, particularly as things have loosened up in El Salvador to a certain extent, and it's been possible to carry out this kind of research more openly. And now it's believed that the figure may have been as high as 50,000 by some estimates. And most historians put it somewhere in between at 30,000. All at the behest of the dictator Maximiliano Hernández Martínez, who was, of course, supported by Washington. And this was at a period when the traditional communal lands of the peasants, and particularly of the Tipil Indians, who are a sort of a linguistic subgroup of the greater Maya family, were having their lands appropriated from them by the coffee industry, which was rapidly booming, so the coffee could be exported to breakfast tables in Gringolandia. And, you know, it was the usual story where the Pipil Indians had been growing corn and beans on their traditional village lands since before the conquest, since before the arrival of the Spanish. And yet, you know, these lands had never been officially titled to them. So it was very easy for the coffee barons to swindle them out of their lands or just merely appropriate their lands by force of arms. And what had traditionally been village lands in the 1930s were increasingly coming over under the control of the famous 14 families who ran the coffee industry in El Salvador. And the campesinos and the indígenas pipiles were unable to feed themselves on you know, being pushed into more and more marginal lands, or finally being left without any lands, and were being reduced to virtual slave labor, to a captive workforce in debt peonage on the coffee plantations. So once again, this history kind of went down the Orwellian memory hole under the military dictatorships in El Salvador. It was sort of forbidden to talk about this period for a long, long time. Really there hasn't been enough scholarship on it. But what there is sort of suggests that Farabundo Martí was less the leader of the insurrection than he was the catalyst. And most of the accounts that have been written of the incidents of the Matanza have been quick to emphasize the red terror aspect of the episode, and quick to emphasize, you know, that the owners of the coffee plantations and their families were you know, taken captive and in some cases, you know, killed and mutilated and so on. The scholarship is focused on this sort of thing, and also, of course, on the role of Farabundo Martí and the notion that it was all a Moscow conspiracy. Well, first of all, there's something a little bit perverse about focusing on the violence which was committed by the insurrectionists, where you know, the death toll which they racked up couldn't have been more than scores, whereas the army repression which put down the insurrection may have been as high as 50,000 of unarmed peasants. Okay, they had machetes, but they didn't have firearms. But more to the point is that, as I say, I think that the official leadership, such as most explicitly Farabundo Martí, they served more as catalysts than they did as the actual directors of the uprising, and that really this was an indigenous revolt, a campesino revolt, and an indigenous revolt, and was about you know, taking back lands from the coffee oligarchy and trying to reestablish self-sufficiency and indigenous culture. And in the immediate aftermath, this is something else which has not received nearly enough scholarship. And even a lot of the, you know, leftist historical primers on El Salvador, which abounded in the 1980s, of course, failed to emphasize that in the immediate aftermath of the Matanza, the dictatorship of Maximiliano Hernandez essentially outlawed indigenous culture. And it became verboten in El Salvador to speak the indigenous language of the Pipiles. and the indigenous dress and indigenous customs and ceremonies and so on of the Pipiles were banned on pain of death. I mean, I'm not sure if laws were actually passed because it was a lawless situation, but certainly in the indigenous culture of the Pipil Indians was very, very, very effectively suppressed in El Salvador in the immediate aftermath of the Matanza of 1932. And there was this official fiction which continued to reign that, you know, El Salvador is one of these countries in Latin America where there aren't any Indians. All of the Indians have been exterminated. That became the official line. And, you know, one of my criticisms of the FMLN is that they failed to sufficiently challenge this, and that they sort of, you know, bought into the whole sort of Marxist-Leninist notion of proletarianizing the campesinos. Nonetheless, since the I understand that since the return to democracy, since the peace accords of 1992, and it's, you know, been possible for the left to organize openly, and we're just seeing the fruits of that now. Similarly, it has become possible for indigenous culture to re-emerge openly without fear of reprisal or persecution. And amazingly, after two generations, or more like three generations, right, of almost complete suppression from the Matanza of 1932 right on through to the 1990s, the indigenous culture is beginning to reemerge in El Salvador. And the Pipil language, which people had thought was extinct, is once again being taught to the young in certain enclaves in rural El Salvador, mostly in Morazan province along the Honduran border, from what I understand. El Salvador is the one country in Central America that I have not visited, because when I was traveling around down there in the 1980s, it was very difficult to get in because of the war. And you couldn't just show up at the border you know, get your passport stamped. So, you know, it's a place I'd really love to go, and I'd especially love to go there now, and I would love to see how the Pipil Indians are doing and how their cultural renaissance is coming along in the new climate. And hopefully, you know, there can be now there can be something of a, as there was in Guatemala, by the way, something of a convergence between the indigenous cultural revival and the more narrowly defined left-wing revolutionary movements. You know, in Guatemala, the Indians are the big majority of the population. So there, you know, the process was more open, more advanced, and it wasn't so easy for the ruling military regime to perpetrate the fiction that there aren't any Indians, because they were the huge majority in the country. Something like 70% or something of Guatemala's inhabitants are Maya Indians. So I hope that we can begin to see the same sort of process begin to happen in El Salvador now, even though they've got you know, much harder road to hoe there in terms of bringing back indigenous culture, because indigenous cultures are not merely important in terms of you know, their own inherent right to survive and their own inherent right to cultural autonomy, but also because indigenous peoples, particularly in you know, the ones who are still rooted to the land and in places where there are organic links between the indigenous culture and the greater campesino culture or peasant culture, which is the case in much of Latin America, particularly Central America, indigenous culture is a means by which sustainable culture, ecologically sustainable culture, can begin to regenerate itself, because this is where, you know, the deep memory is of how to live sustainably. And particularly as we're moving into a post-petroleum age, there's a lot that indigenous cultures have to offer, not only to themselves, but to the rest of us as well. So my shout out tonight to the indigenous pipiles of El Salvador. I wish I had some of their music to play, just as we heard some Irish Gaelic from Karen Casey. I hope somebody out there could understand it. And, okay, I'm going to play one more somber song, and then hopefully we'll have time to go out with just a little bit more of a solace on a bit more of a, on a bit more of an up tip. Well, I just need to note that, of course, this is going to be the big anniversary of the beginning of a war. This week, as we just heard, one of the Alphabet Soup left-wing outfits is going to be holding a gig up in Union Square on Thursday to commemorate the start of the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, on my birthday. Thank you so much, George Bush. What a sweet, thoughtful birthday present. I really appreciate it so much. So, George, this one is for you. This one is for George Bush, and going taking the Wayback Machine here. Here a little bit of Richard and Mimi Farina, and then hopefully we'll have time to go off a little bit more solas. Now we got to give it up for Weaponry with Tom Whisker. Here, George, this is for you.
Dressed in helmet and sword, and dip our tongues in slaughter.